Hello and welcome to a new edition of Pro Money Talk. I'm Jason Papier, along with my co-host Peter Johnson, and we've got a really great show for you today. We'll be getting back to the basics a bit today, talking about college savings plans and value investing. In the first segment, Nick Waschesen will be asking questions about saving for a child's education. Nick's worked in our office for several years as an IT consultant, and he plays a vital role in getting our show up every week. He's the engineer. Before working with us, Nick got a degree in film and radio production and has done voiceover work. I think he does a nice job with this interview. In our second segment, Peter will be interviewing Russ Town of Town Investments. Russ is a value investor in the mold of Warren Buffett and shares his approach to investing with our listeners. Russ focuses on investing in great companies at great prices, and in doing so, attempts to simultaneously reduce risk and beat the market. I think you'll find his level-headed approach very interesting. If you're new to Pro Money Talk or have not visited our website, please go to www.promoneytalk.com. There you'll find old shows, information about us, and can sign up for our email list. Signing up for the list gives you the opportunity to ask us questions we may answer on the air. You'll also receive updates about new show topics every week. Once again, that's www.promoneytalk.com. Thank you, and enjoy our show.
I found an article on the internet that you had written, and in the first few paragraphs you talk about the material and psychological benefits of having a higher education, and I think you summed it up well by saying that higher education provides opportunity. But I also found it interesting that you used the term higher education and not just college. I had always thought the two were synonymous. Is there a difference?
When I say higher education, I'm referring to a post-secondary education. So oftentimes when parents or students hear about these opportunities for saving, they're referred to as college savings opportunities. And really that's not true. A lot of the programs are marketed that way, but they're actually structured so that any student can use them for post-secondary education. Now what I mean by post-secondary is college, of course, is post-secondary, but also trade schools. I think that a true craftsman in any profession has a greater job satisfaction and personal respect than the average worker. Becoming a craftsman requires time, dedication, love, and discipline, but it starts with an education. So I encourage any relative of a young child to save, even a very small amount, in one of the programs that we'll talk about, to provide the opportunity to become a chef, engineer, accountant, or simply to give the child the ability to make more money and the ability to realize their dreams.
You mentioned the relatives should be saving money, not just the parents, for higher education, which seems to underscore the fact that higher education is costly and is growing more expensive all the time.
Yeah, you're right. Prices for higher education continue to rise. According to the College Board, in 2003-2004, four-year private college tuition rates increased an average of 6%. Over the past 10, 15, 20 years, we've seen private schools increasing at a higher rate than inflation, at a much higher rate than inflation, actually. And so it's becoming more and more difficult for parents to save for college. One thing that I think is worth mentioning is that it's my opinion that public school costs are going to start to outstrip private schools.
So public schools are going to become more expensive faster.
That's right.
Than private schools.
Because the discrepancy right now is just too large between public school and private schools. But also, states are under increasing pressure, budget pressure. A lot of the state schools, especially in California, are in poor condition. So the schools need more money, and the states are not able to spend as much money.
How much does college cost these days?
I'm always reluctant to talk about the cost of saving for future education, because when you start to talk about the actual costs, it can be frightening.
Are there ways that you can offset the costs of education? I know there's scholarships and grants and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Can you even count on covering a certain percentage of higher education with scholarships and grants?
Well, it really depends on the child and the family. Financial aid calculations are done at the family level.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's very important. Almost 60% of undergraduate students receive some form of financial aid. So when I talk about saving for college, one of the reasons that I'm reluctant to quote the actual costs that are shown in a lot of studies is because most people don't pay that much.
Mm-hmm.
Most people pay only a fraction of that. So obviously ability to pay is one factor. Another factor with scholarships could be some unique ability that a student has. But in determining how much a parent or relatives should save, you really have to do a financial aid calculation to determine what they're likely to get in financial aid.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also want to see how old the child is, how long they have until college, because that'll be part of your saving strategy as well. So I think there are calculators online that you can use, but it really pays to see a college planning specialist to determine how much you should be saving.
I see. And what are the methods of saving? What are the savings vehicles? Are there any that have tax advantages?
There are some savings vehicles that have tax advantages. First, I'm going to talk to you about the various options for educational savings. There are six main options that people use, and they're not equally good, but I want to make sure that we discuss them so that when you hear about friends or relatives or other people who are using them, you don't wonder, why aren't we using that, or is that a better savings vehicle? So the six major options are 529 savings accounts, Coverdell education savings accounts, which were formerly known as education IRAs, just gifting money to a student,
mm-hmm,
or a child, saving in a traditional savings account, in other words, saving your own money,
right,
in a savings account to use, retirement accounts are sometimes used, and certain U.S. savings bonds can be used. Of the six major options, gifting money to students in savings accounts are the least desirable, in my opinion. Savings accounts have no tax advantages, and so should be eliminated first.
Okay.
In other words, having just the money sitting in your own savings account, you get absolutely no tax advantage for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be eliminated first. Giving money to a student under the Uniform Gift to Minors Act has several drawbacks. First, you as the gifter are responsible for paying any gifting taxes. Now, there's $11,000 that you can gift to anybody each year. So if you gift more than $11,000 in a year to the student, you have to pay gifting taxes. But even staying under that $11,000 limit, there are some major drawbacks. One of the biggest ones is that the money is now in the child's name. And at age 18, that child can choose to spend the money however he or she wants. That might not be for education, or that might not be for the items that you want. But also, because the money is in the child's name, it has an unfavorable financial aid treatment. Financial aid calculations treat money in a child's account versus a money in a parent's account differently.
So does that mean that a child who's been gifted a large sum of money is less likely to receive financial aid?
That's exactly right. Lastly, while minors might have a lower income tax rate, the tax savings still don't compete with tax advantage plans available for education purposes. So I would rule out saving and gifting as two methods for saving for child's education. So at this point, we're left with four tax advantaged options: the 529 accounts, the Coverdells, savings bonds, and certain retirement accounts, particularly IRAs such as a Roth IRA. So we'll try and eliminate a couple more of those right now.
Okay.
While some IRAs currently allow for withdrawal for education, the plans really weren't designed as education savings accounts. They really are designed as retirement savings accounts.
Mm-hmm.
So it worries me that at some point that opportunity might be closed by tax legislation. You never know what is going to happen with taxation and legislation, but I feel more comfortable participating in programs that were designed for specific purpose and participating in them for that purpose rather than using like a loophole, because loopholes are more likely to be closed and, even more importantly perhaps, not grandfathered back in.
Right.
The second one that we'll discount are the bonds. Certain savings bonds have the ability to be cashed in tax-free if they are used for higher education. The reason I'm going to discount that is because in the other two accounts, the two that are remaining, the 529s and the Coverdell accounts, you can hold bonds, you can hold stocks, you can hold a variety of securities. So it just simply gives you more choices and more opportunity in those accounts. So the two that we have left are 529 savings accounts and the Coverdell savings accounts. 529 plans, first of all, 529 plans were named after the section of the federal tax code that refers to them. So it was section 529, and that's why we call them 529 plans. So the federal tax code allowed each state to set up these college savings plans. And every state now has a 529 plan. In fact, several states have multiple 529 plan opportunities. What's important to note is that you don't have to be the resident of a state to contribute to its plan. So for instance, if I'm a resident of California, I can contribute to a 529 for any other state in the union. And states are actually competing against each other to get this money.
Are the states responsible for plan administration and investments?
While the states administer the programs, another party, usually an established financial institution, is responsible for the investment options. So, for example, California's plan is called the California ScholarShare Program, and its investment options are administered by TIAA CREF. Now, talking about 529s, 529 accounts are considered assets of the custodian, so the parent or grandparent, with the student named as the beneficiary. This allows for greater eligibility for financial aid. So that's going to be looked at as parents' assets and assessed at 5.6% rate rather than the 35% rate, even though the child is the named beneficiary on it. Additionally, the beneficiary designation can be revoked or moved to another family member at any time. So for instance, if I have two children and I have a 529 account set up for each of them, I can roll, let's say the older's, if there's money left over, I can roll that to the younger child. And in fact, I can roll that to any family member. And family member is used very loosely in this definition. It can be children, it can be nieces, nephews, cousins. It's a really, they give you a lot of opportunity. So the money can be rolled over without penalty to any family member at any time.
How much can a family contribute to a child's 529 plan?
Each contributor to a 529 account can contribute $11,000 a year to the account. I can contribute $10,000 to an account. My wife can contribute $10,000 to our child's account. The child's grandmother and grandfather can also contribute $10,000 or $11,000. The account, so it can add up very quickly. What's also interesting is that in the first year that you contribute, you can prepay 5 years without penalty. So in the first year, I can put $55,000 away into one child's college savings account, and my wife can do the same thing. So we can effectively put $110,000 into our child's account.
And that's without taxes, without the gifting tax?
That's right, without gifting tax in year one. Now, the next 4 years, you're unable to contribute, but you've been able to take a big portion and put it up front. Now, it is considered the parents' money for financial aid treatment. For estate planning, it's a little bit differently, and you'd want to talk to an estate planning attorney, but you get the money out of your estate when you put it in the 529 plan. And in fact, creditors, this was just passed down by the Supreme Court recently, 529s also have creditor protection, just like IRAs do.
How big can these accounts end up becoming?
The lifetime value of a 529 account can usually exceed $200,000. In fact, in California ScholarShare plan, it's $280,000. So you can save a substantial amount of money in these plans. Unlike most other types of savings vehicles, 529s have no limits of contributions by those with higher income levels. It doesn't matter how much you make, you're still eligible to contribute to a 529 plan. Finally, 529s usually feature options designed to take the guesswork out of the investing process. This is called age-based investment plans. I'll talk more about it later, but it's something that I strongly suggest for people who aren't actively managing that account, and most people aren't. The primary concern with the 529 plans, the law that allows for the savings plans, is set to expire in 2010. However, there are numerous bills in front of Congress right now for extending or making permanent 529 plans. One should be passed like this year. They're just haggling over the particulars right now.
So you can't really count on this plan to be a long-term savings plan until the government has made it a permanent.
I don't agree with that, because 529 plans, unlike, say, Roth IRAs, are designed for college savings. Mm-hmm. And so what would happen most likely is that even if they decided not to continue to offer 529 programs, which is very, very unlikely, they would still grandfather in the money that's been put in and been saved. So I don't see any risk in contributing right now. You may, there's a very, very slight chance that you may not be able to contribute anymore after 2010.
Uh-huh.
But I would say there's virtually no chance that they would not allow for withdrawals to be tax-free. The only penalty that you will have is if you withdraw the money and it's not used for education. And education, by the way, education, the definition of education, again, is pretty broad. It's not just tuition. It's tuition, it's room, it's board, it's books, it's computers, it's learning devices, it's supplies, basically anything that pertains to a child going to college.
Uh-huh.
Or any other higher education institution is covered under that. So they allow you to save not just for tuition, but for the entire cost of college.
There were two plans we were going to focus on, 529s, which you just talked about, and CoverDells. So what can you tell us about CoverDells?
CoverDells have two drawbacks when compared to 529s, but one major advantage, so we'll talk about that. The first drawback is that CoverDells have income limits for contributors. So joint filers are ineligible to contribute during any year that their modified adjusted gross income is above $220,000. The contribution limits are reduced along a sliding scale for those with a modified adjusted gross income between $190,000 and $220,000. So if the first drawback is that if you make more than $220,000, you can't use a CoverDell. The second drawback is that CoverDells have low contribution limits. Each contributor can only contribute $2,000 a year to a CoverDell. Additionally, each beneficiary can only receive a total of $2,000 combined per year in the account. So what that means is, in this case, I could not contribute $2,000 and have my wife contribute $2,000 to the same child's account. The child can only get $2,000. Similarly, I could not contribute $2,000 to one child's account and $2,000 to my next child's account, because I can only contribute a total of $2,000 in a year. So those are the two main drawbacks. But where CoverDells really shine, and this can be very valuable, is in their flexibility for funding lower education. CoverDells can be used to pay tuition fees, supplies, and equipment costs for elementary and secondary school. This includes computers, software, and of course tuition. So if you plan on a child going to a private high school, for instance,
mm-hmm.
makes a lot of sense if you're eligible to contribute money to a CoverDell. Even if they're not going to a private institution, though, the costs of supplies and computers can still be expensive, and this is a nice way to take some money that would otherwise be taxable and set it aside in a tax advantage program. But unlike 529s, they're not sponsored by state or any other government agency. Therefore, they can be open virtually anywhere with unlimited investing options. So you could go, a lot of banks offer them. You can go and open up a CoverDell at your bank, or your brokerage account will most likely offer CoverDell. Because they're not regulated by the state, you can invest that money in anything. It's just like a personal account. You can do whatever you want. 529s are a lot like 401ks in that you have choices that you can use, and they limit your choices. CoverDells are wide open. So in most cases, I encourage clients to participate in both CoverDells and 529s if they can. The CoverDells we use for elementary and secondary school funding, and the 529s we use for college or post-secondary school education.
If every state offers a 529, how do you determine which state has the best plan for your needs?
Researching 529 plans can be pretty daunting. As I mentioned, every state has one, and many states have several. A good reference for those who are interested is website www.savingforcollege.com. That website compares plans from every state and contains a lot of valuable information. Currently, the plan that I am having our clients use is New York's Direct 529 plan. New York's plan is one of the largest in the country. The program investment manager is Vanguard. For those not familiar with Vanguard, it's one of the largest and most respected mutual fund companies in the country. Vanguard is known for having very good fund options with very low expense ratios. The program's administrator is UPromise, which focuses entirely on education savings plans. The combined management fee and fund fee for the 529 is very low at 58 basis points, or 0.58%. That's the lowest in the country. The New York plan has 15 different investment options, including 3 age-based allocation options. You can change investment options once a year or anytime you change the beneficiary. And finally, if your employer participates, you can have contributions deducted regularly from your paycheck. I found to be a really good way to ensure participation. One thing to note is that in California, we do not have any state tax breaks for putting money away into a education plan. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is that all the money that you put in is going to be post-tax. However, some states offer tax breaks that allow you to deduct the money that you contribute to a plan from your income when filing for your state income taxes. In those states, it usually makes sense to use that state's plan. But for those of us and those of our clients who are not, we have the choice of every state. Really, there's no advantage to one versus the other inherently. It just depends on the plans themselves.
What kind of follow-up action is required once you've signed up for a plan and contributed to it?
Plan maintenance is a major factor in successfully saving for a child's education. What may be appropriate today may not be appropriate in the future. As I said, when looking at the investments, you want to look at the time horizon. So the longer time a child has until they're going to reach college, most often the more you want to have in equities, and the closer that they get to needing the money, the more you're going to have in fixed income like bonds. Most of the investors that I work with just don't have the time or expertise to keep up on their investments. It's a full-time job. So with that in mind, I strongly urge investors who will not be using a financial planner to seek investment alternatives that are actively allocated. In the case of college savings, that means using a 529 with an age-based allocation. Age-based allocations take into consideration the child's age and how long the money will be invested. They automatically place more into equities at the start and move more to fixed incomes as the time horizon shortens. Age-based allocations are designed so that you do not have to monitor that aspect of your investment. Now remember that Coverdales do not offer age-based allocations, so they should be reviewed regularly and modified as needed. Also, time horizons on Coverdales are usually going to be shorter than on a 529. So make sure that your investments reflect that.
So aside from that website that you mentioned, savingforcollege.com?
That's right.
Are there any other kind of resources that we can find out about to sort of refresh our memories on the 529s, Coverdells, and other savings college plans?
Yeah, you can go to the College Board, collegeboard.org. They always have good information about financial aid, typical costs for college. I will post one of the articles that I've written on our website on Pro Money Talk. Actually, we'll most likely just put a link in the show notes to it, and you can click on that and read in a little bit more detail, and certainly with more time, you can read. I also have a chart in there that shows the typical price of various colleges, in-state public, 2-year in-state, 4-year in-state, for your out-of-state public, for your private, and it sort of breaks down how much you should save if you're not going to get any financial aid, how much you'll need to be putting away on a monthly basis depending on how old your child is and depending on what type of school he or she is most likely to attend.
Okay, that sounds good. There are these two plans that you recommend, the 529 and the Coverdell. Once you've made the determination that one plan is better for you than another, what's the next step? Where do you go to open up one of these savings plans?
Good. So the next step is, if you choose a Coverdell, the next step is to go to your bank or your broker and talk to them about opening up a Coverdell. If it's going to be a 529, again, you're going to want to decide what state you need to use. You'll want to research that. Does your state offer income tax deductions for contributions? If so, you'll probably want to use your state's. If not, you'll want to research. Again, I'm currently using the New York plan. Those change because states are competing against each other. Those may change on a fairly regular basis, mm-hmm. which plan is the best at any given moment. So you'll want to keep up to date on that. Again, savingforcollege.com is a great resource for that. Once you determine what state, there will be on savingforcollege.com, there's a link for each state's plan. There's a link to go directly, or you can just search the internet and find it. They make it fairly easy. You typically just subscribe online.
So there's a link. You type in your information, you type in your child's information, and you go through the process.
Can you offer us any other kind of tips or tricks, some more advice on saving for college?
Well, I think the important thing when you're saving for an education, there's a couple things. First of all, is just to note how important it is to help save for a child's education, and that these days it's really a family effort. It's difficult, oftentimes, for just the parents to be able to save for a child's education. And these programs allow parents, grandparents, other relatives to help save. For instance, with my nephews, we have a large family, and so every time it's a birthday or Christmas, they get all sorts of presents, more than they can possibly handle. And my wife and I will instead write a check to them, and they can put it in the 529. And little kids know the value of money right away. They love seeing that check, even though it's going into the college plan. So I guess the first thing is that it's really a family effort and not just the parents' effort. The second thing is to not be discouraged at the amount of money that it can take to save for the full education of college. As I said, first of all, 60% of students get financial aid. Half of the students get grant aid, which means it's not even paid back. And almost 30% of students attending four-year colleges paid less than $4,000 for tuition fees per year. So college aid can be a substantial resource. What's important is not to wait until you feel like you can start to contribute. What's important is to set something up and contribute right away. Most of the plans, if you set them up and if you're having money deducted from your paycheck, you can have contributions of as little as $15 a month going into a 529 plan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy and it's a good way to start. So my advice is get the whole family involved, educate the family, and start right away and start with whatever you can. The answer to how much should I save for college is save what you can.
Mm. Well, thanks a lot, Jason.
My pleasure.
Okay, today we're fortunate to be talking to Russ Town of Town Investments LLC in Campbell, California. Russ is an investment advisor and a stock picker, whereas in our practice we tend to use mutual funds. Russ selects individual stocks for his clients, and we are recording on location in beautiful Southern California in Capistrano Beach. And if I sound a little nasally today, it's because I have a bit of an allergy going on, I think. But welcome to the show, Russ.
Thank you, Peter. Pleasure to be here.
As a person who is not a stock picker, I have questions that I'd like to get answered today. And I know that a lot of our listeners already have stocks. They're wondering what to do with them. And some of them want to learn more about investing in stocks. So I think today's show will be especially helpful in that sense. But first, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, what you do, and how you got started?
Sure, happy to. I've had a passion for stocks for a long time, and it's not the stock so much as the business. I've been a business person. I've had founded and run several businesses over the years. Been self-employed most of my life. So the investing portion came about as a result of my love for business.
Mm.
And the more I learned about them and how to run businesses and what made effective businesses, I realized that I wanted to be able to invest in other businesses.
Uh-huh.
And a very simple way of doing that is doing it through the stock market. And I began investing in the stock market and made a lot of the same mistakes that I think most people make when they first start out. And over time, I was pretty disappointed in my results. I didn't like when I followed typical magazine articles or suggestions or stock tips or whatever. It just didn't get me where I wanted to go, and I could tell I didn't have the recipe. So what I've been doing from that sense of frustration is I started looking at the masters, the grand masters, those that have outperformed the market consistently on a long-term cumulative basis for decades, in some cases 50 years. And I saw what they did over and over again, and I learned it as best I could. I basically became a student of investing and been hopefully getting better and better at it throughout the years here.
And you've been doing your own stock picking for how long?
I was wondering that the other day. I don't really know. It might have been 80s or I believe it was somewhere in the 80s that I actually started doing it. But I actually became, interestingly, it was during the early part of the dot-com boom that I actually began really understanding effective investment strategies. And the timing was interesting because for a several-year period, the most effective investing strategies didn't appear to be working. It was during the time when companies without earnings and the companies that didn't even have effective business models were soaring, whereas the highest quality companies were actually not doing very well in the marketplace. So it was really a trial by fire. It was really good for me ultimately because I tested my faith over and over again and I hung with it and I believed it. I became a true believer during that time. And it's served me very well when the bust came.
I've heard professionals say that they wouldn't trust somebody unless they've been through a down market. And things were certainly upside down in 1999, as you mentioned. Can you tell us a little bit about your investment method and what your aim is and what you're trying to achieve?
Sure. Basically, I think stock market investing, intelligent or effective stock market investing, is much similar to any other kind of effective investing. Basically, find exceptional assets, find out to determine what they're really worth, and attempt to buy them at prices that are substantially below their true value. So it's kind of a three-step process.
And your aim is to achieve what for your clients?
Both for myself and for my clients, mm-hmm. is to acquire wonderful assets, and like I said, at great prices, and then based on the combination of the quality of the assets and the price we paid for them, have superior investment results, while at the same time reducing risk. Usually, I think people become persuaded that you have to have increased risk to have outperformance, and I believe the inverse is absolutely true. The less risk you take in many cases, the better your long-term cumulative performance is going to be.
Well, that's the best of both worlds. If you can reduce risk and increase your returns, sort of the holy grail. Well, you have three basic investing principles. You mentioned them a minute ago. Could you go over them again and perhaps elaborate on each one in a little bit of detail?
Certainly. For example, finding superior assets or great companies, as I like to call them, it's important to be on the right horse. A lot of investors try to beat the market by jumping on the cheetah that moves real fast quickly, and it's an exciting ride, and you tend to move a short distance very fast, but ultimately many investors are going to get mauled by that process. I would rather jump on a thoroughbred that's bred for endurance and ride that horse for as long as it's able to continue to beat the market. So for example, what would I look for in a great company? Are some pretty simple things to look for. It's not as hard to identify a great company as many people are led to believe. For example, if a company, I'd first of all start with a track record of at least 10 years, because that way you get to see how the company performed in good markets, bad markets, good economies, bad economies. You get to really have a good feel for the company, and that increases your law of probability that you're going to end up being able to have outperformance in the future if they've outperformed for substantial distances in the past. So that's one of them. A key one to me is, are they generating cash, extra cash, quite often called free cash flow or just cash flow in general, but if they're able to generate far more cash than they need to run their business and stay competitive, that's usually a sign of a wonderful business. They're quite rare. But to find them is a huge gem, and that's worth a lot. I look for honest management, what I like to call shareholder-friendly management. They're competent. They're really looking after the best interest of the shareholders, who are the true owners of the companies. They are experienced, but most importantly from that standpoint is they just have integrity. Without integrity, all the rest of it can actually be used against the shareholder, but with integrity, you can put the package together and really it's like having a wonderful jockey on top of a wonderful horse. That combination is a huge winning combination. I have a couple other variables that are particularly valuable, I think, that are useful. Sustainable competitive advantage. Quite often, if you're finding companies throwing off lots of cash, they're doing it because they have something that their competitors do not. Sometimes it's called a moat, like around a castle, to protect them from their competition. And the best companies will tend to be the ones that have these huge protective barriers that they've constructed, some real competitive advantages that not only today, but they're likely to have tomorrow and the next day. Those castles that you see when you go to Europe or Japan or someplace that are thousands of years old, quite often it's because they had a moat around them that were able to allow them to last much longer than most buildings in other parts of the world.
So that could be a patent, and they have a certain process, a secret formula, perhaps even barriers to entry are difficult in their field.
Quite often it's a barrier to entry issue. For example, Dell Computer has the efficiency of their manufacturing is a key one. Coca-Cola, it's their distribution model that you can buy a Coke almost anywhere in the world at any given time. So it's just something that makes it very, very difficult for another competitor to truly compete and to take them out of the first place running. Another couple of key ones is relatively little or no debt. This is important because, first of all, I believe that if a company has a lot of debt, it quite often means that the management has made mistakes, and debt is a symptom of mistakes quite often, or just inferior management in general. But it removes flexibility, management flexibility, and leads to bankruptcy, and quite often leads to bankruptcy. And one of the key problems for bankruptcy for equity investors or stock investors is that you lose everything. You don't just lose 30% or 50%. You can lose 100% of your money when a company that you thought was going to make it goes bankrupt. So it's important to watch for the really healthy companies. And the last one as far as for this program, growth rates that are consistently beat the market. It's also a real important one. And there's a couple ways to consistently beat the market. One is just to have a growth rate that is faster than the market. But another one is to have one that is more consistent than the market. That over the course of time, it may not beat the market every year, but it just needs to beat the market more often than not on a long-term basis to beat the market on a long-term basis.
The tortoise and the hare.
Yep.
I know in real estate, if there's a lot of debt that you have to carry, if your occupancy rate goes down and you're not able to cover the basic debt, the mortgage, if you have that debt hanging over your head, that can cause a business to go out, or a company to go out of business in a down market. And similarly, if the economy falls off and a business's revenues drop, then they have to be able to cover the debt. If they don't have debt, they've got a lot more flexibility and they can probably position themselves well even during a down market.
Yes, the companies with the least debt that tend to do best during a down market and actually gain competitive share, gain competitive strength during that time. Quite often it's the bad markets that make the best companies.
So, again, we're talking about your three primary investment principles. Finding great companies is step number one, and obviously it takes a little bit of homework, so you don't have to be a genius or trained in high finance to do this, but you do have to do your homework, and you have to think about it a little bit. Okay, so the second primary investing principle that you have is identifying what a company's worth. When I was in school, they taught us that we're investing for the future return, which really comes from only two sources. It comes from dividends, or it comes from the stock price when you ultimately sell the stock. So given that you're going to get this stream of returns in the future, and that's the real return to you, how do you go about figuring what a company is worth and what to pay for it?
I actually use several different what I call value indicators. I try to figure it out using each of them and then try to come up with my best guess based on those.
Okay, so you've got several indicators, seven indicators that you use when you're looking at the value of a stock, and they're broken down into two parts.
Basically I'm looking at the historical valuations, and then I'm looking at projections, like projected cash flow and that kind of thing. So they tend to be fall into the one category or the other.
On the historical basis, you've said that you use certain ratios, you know, price to earnings, price to cash flow, price to book value, and so on. I want our listeners to know that those sound like technical terms, but what they are is a measure of what price people are willing to pay for those different benefits, the cash flow or the book value or the earnings. So already we're talking about the value part of investing. Not only what do you get, but what do you pay for it, which is really important.
Mm-hmm. And where that comes from, by the way, why look at back in the past is that with the efficient market theory, there's a belief that the market is efficient most of the time, and I believe that to be true. It's efficient most of the time. I don't believe it's efficient all of the time, but it's efficient often enough that if you look at a 10-year average, you're going to see some pretty relatively accurate assessments of what the company has been worth at these various stages for the 10 years.
So by efficient, it's an academic term, meaning that the market, with the information given, that most investors will pick a reasonable, rational price, that it's priced where it should be. That's what the term efficient means.
Right, and so I use that as an average, but I also use the inefficiency of the market. I believe that there's enough inefficiencies of the market that one can, once you realize what the real value of a company is, that you can then move on into the looking for the inefficiencies where it's out of whack with, where the current price is out of whack with what I would consider the real value to be. And it is in that difference in the valuations versus the price that where the, a lot of the profit can come from in stock market investing.
So your second step is to determine what a company is worth, what a fair price for a company is.
Mm-hmm.
And the third, which is taken from that second step, is if X is a fair price for the company, then you know when it's selling at a discount and it might be attractive to buy it.
That's correct. And valuing a company, even people that are real familiar with the industry and industry experts will disagree on an actual value of the company, a real value of a company. So the idea of building a discount in or a margin of safety that encompasses it. If I think I can get within 15% accuracy of what a company is really worth, then I just want to make sure that my percentage discount or margin of safety is greater than the 15%. So I build in some protection for myself. So I might have 30% discount or margin of safety. And that, say that I'll buy it only when share price today is indicating at least that big of a discount.
So you're saying that there is no one fair price for a company. You're never going to have absolute assurance that you know what exactly what a company is worth.
That tends to be correct, yes.
And in order to make a better investment decision, the cheaper you can buy it compared to what you think is a fair price, it not only gives you more upside potential, but it also protects on the downside in case you're a little bit wrong, that the stock price, when it gets back to normal valuation or in that range, you're going to have less risk and greater returns, like you said earlier.
Precisely. I talked a little bit about the less risk portion, but it's also a potential profit multiplier, magnifier,
mm-hmm.
where if I'm buying it at a 30% discount and I'm reasonably accurate as to what the value is, the market is likely to, because of its efficiency, the market is likely to eventually get to the fact that it's underpriced. It will tend to raise the price to the point where it's at least back at its real value. And at that point, I've made the nice difference. If it was a 30% discount, I tend to make a 30% bump right there in my potential unrealized gain at that point.
Or even more, because if it's down to 70 and it goes back up to 100, it went down 30%, but it went up more than 30%.
Yes, and then if a company, that same company, because it's a great company to begin with, let's say it's growing 12 to 15% or 20% a year, I'm also getting the gain from that, typically, because the intrinsic or the real value of a company tends to follow earnings growth and cash flow growth and that kind of thing. So if it's growing 15% a year, I'm likely to see my investments over time growing also 15% a year for that particular one.
So you're saying you're a careful shopper.
Yes.
You think about it, you study prices, you look around, and you make your judgments on an informed basis.
Precisely. Good investors will tend to buy shares of companies the same way they buy most other goods, such as groceries, rather than buying it like perfume. Oftentimes people spend extra for perfume because
it has a certain brand or cachet to
right.
it.
But investing is much more like you buy a good quality of other good and you're buying it for the least expensive price that you can, so you're getting the best value.
You're taking some of the emotion out of the decision and making it on an analytical, you know, cool-headed basis. I'm wondering if the market's mostly efficient and you're finding some bargains, what makes a company fall out of its fair value range?
Excellent.
How does it get down to be cheap, and how often does that happen?
Yes, a wonderful question, because great companies don't tend to get as cheap as other companies will tend to be quite often. But it's amazing how often it happens, and for somewhat ridiculous reasons sometimes, it'll be a temporary difficulty that a great company will experience. A good example, a company called Stryker. They have been growing 20% a year for many, many, many years, and they bought a company that was about their competitor of theirs that was about their size. Well, it impacted their earnings for a brief period of time while they were absorbing the cost of the acquisition. It was actually a wonderful event for the company. They were able to grow sales much more rapidly. They got rid of a competitor, price competition, all of that. I recognized that that was a temporary thing that impacted the stock pretty heavily. Stock price got impacted pretty heavily, but the company itself had actually made a better company in this example. So that's a perfect example. I was able to buy a company at a substantial discount to what it has historically been worth, or what I felt it was worth, the real value, with minimal risk, and picked up a great investment.
That's terrific. You do have to have a sense of what something's really worth and be ready to buy it when the opportunity comes up.
Yes. Preparation and patience are two key things for an investor to have.
There are a lot of reasons, I think, that prices do get out of whack. Sometimes the market's focusing on another factor or something simple. They may not be looking deeply enough within a company's real story. Like you said, behind the scenes something good was going on, but the surface person who was looking at a shallow measure, just the price-earnings ratio, saw that falling off and would run.
Exactly. The dot-com bust generated some wonderful opportunities. I was able to pick up a Maxim Semiconductor for a price that I thought was substantially below what it was really worth. And what was happening is a lot of the tech companies were getting discounted at the same time because of the bust. I was throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Guilt by association.
Exactly. And so I found some companies in that category that actually did quite well during the entire bust period, and yet their prices looked as though they were destroyed. So I was able to pick up some good ones, and that's another way to do it. You look for opportunity, and you wait for the opportunity, and then you pounce. And ideally, the preparation and the building up and the patience has allowed you to build up some resources available. So when you find the great companies at the great prices, you jump with a substantial amount of focus. You put quite a bit of your investment there because your confidence level is so high. And when I find those, my confidence level is quite high that this is the probability of me being successful with that investment is quite good.
I forget who it was that said it, but it was von Rothschild or some baron. He said the best time to invest is when there's blood flowing in the streets, preferably your own. But the tech meltdown was a perfect example of a behavioral part of the market that's not terribly rational. That people are heading for the exits, they are throwing out the baby with the bathwater, and the more extreme, the greater the extreme that the market's going to, perhaps the more opportunity that it will create.
Yes, that's quite true.
So, again, I always emphasize keeping a cool head about it and not being caught up in what other people are feeling or thinking at that time. So maybe it's best to turn off the TV and the talking heads and the fear that you hear there, because there's something going on that's worth paying attention to.
Speaking of fear and greed, I believe it's Warren Buffett that said, be fearful when everyone else is greedy, and greedy when everyone else is fearful. And you're likely to have much better investment results.
Mm-hmm. And there are those times when going against the grain really does pay off. And speaking of going against the grain, I've seen you in rising markets and falling markets, and you always seem to be content and happy about what's going on. You don't seem to be anxious or worried in down markets. Why is that?
For one, it's the quality of the companies I attempt to invest in. Once I've acquired the company, I'm much less interested in the share price of that company on a day-to-day basis than I am what's happening to the company itself. If the company's still growing 15% a year, I really don't care much what the share price is doing, because I know sooner or later the share price is going to reflect the fact that the company is still growing 15% a year. So there's times I bought a company, the share price has dropped 30%, and I haven't had any concern at all, because I knew that company is going to grow 15% a year, year in and year out, and sooner or later the market's going to catch up to it. And so it's a lot easier to be confident and feel good about the situation. When I see a falling market, I look at it as an opportunity to potentially buy more great companies at great values.
Because things eventually do revert to the mean. They get back on track, and those average PEs and price-to-book ratios and so on that you've seen over the last 10 years or more with given companies, they're likely to be returned to that as long as the fundamentals are good.
That's correct. That's what I watch, is the fundamentals. As far as the rising market, well, most people are happy with that. Why I like it is I get to get rewarded for the good work I've put in and the good decisions I've made in the past. That's when those decisions really start showing.
So you seem to focus more on finding an attractive purchase price than a sales price. And I'd like to focus maybe for a couple minutes on when do you sell stocks?
Sure. I think that's another great question. Let me talk a moment again for purchase, and then this will help with the selling piece. The purchase price determines quite often the potential profit of a company. So if you are forced to sell in a weak market, all you really have is the strength of your purchase price to save you or not. Sometimes you don't always have control over when you sell, but you do have control over when you buy, so that's particularly important. There are times I sell, and they include when a company's business fundamentals deteriorate on something that isn't a temporary basis. There are some companies that do buggy whip companies. You could have the world's best buggy whip company, but if the world's changing and buggy whips are gradually going out of style or favor, to remain with that company is no longer a smart investment, even though it might have been for 50 years. So that's a key one. If I see the management change and the new management is less than ethical in my judgment or not shareholder friendly, they're too excessive with their compensation or the annual reports they put out appear to be intentionally vague or misleading, those kinds of companies I will tend to start trimming or just sell out completely.
So is there a certain price point you'd sell a stock at if it got high enough, or if you find a better company to put reinvest the money in?
Thank you for saying that. The typical investor, when they're first starting out, is not going to be able to find a whole bunch of great companies at really great prices. More likely, they're going to find merely good companies, which by itself is a rarity, to find really good companies. But to find good companies at good prices is a good place to start. Start investing small amounts of money, and grow the amounts invested at the time you're growing your experience and your confidence level.
So you might start with small amounts of money, with a couple of companies that look reasonably good, and as time goes on, you sort of parlay that into larger amounts of money as your experience grows, and as your skill grows, you tend to see the better and better opportunities as they come up.
There's that, and then there's also just certain times where the opportunities tend to be around more. At the end of a market cycle, when the things are headed south and the prices are headed south, you're more likely to be able to get better ones. So it's a matter of trading up patiently. A really good stock portfolio can take a lifetime to build, but it just keeps getting better and better.
Oh, I like that concept. Well, I have a much clearer idea from our discussion of how I would go about investing in stocks at this point. I appreciate what you've shared with us. Where can people go to learn more about stock investing, value investing? Can you recommend any books or sources of information that you use?
Certainly. Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger are some of the best investors in the world, and they've been doing it for 40, 50 years. Anything that they have written themselves, I would suggest they be read. Also, Benjamin Graham, Philip Fisher, are another couple of great investors that have helped actually form the investment styles of the greatest investors in the last 30, 40 years, many of them. So those are wonderful places to go to get information. Any reports written by either of Buffett or Munger are just loaded with fun, interesting, easy to understand facts. So I'd really recommend that people read those. And they're free. The nice thing is they're free. Another one that is also free, that's jam-packed with a lot of useful information, is something called Value Line. It can be found at many public libraries. They condense a whole lot of information about 1,700 different companies, all on one page per company, but a lot of information about cash flow and a lot of the historical information can be found free right at the library or on the internet. Yahoo Finance and Morningstar and Standard & Poor's. There's a lot of good free resources out there, and I certainly recommend that people find ones that they're comfortable with and feel like trusted sources for them.
Those sound like some good sources for people to go to. I know that you operate a couple of weblogs, and you have an investment newsletter that's designed to help educate people. What could you share with us about your weblogs and your discussion group?
I created them so that basically to condense down what I've read over the years to hopefully simpler to understand concepts, so that each of them may come up with each article or story may focus on a given idea or concept that all by itself could make somebody a better investor if they just learn it and start utilizing it. Investing can seem complicated and can appear complicated initially, but if you can learn just one insight a day one basic insight or simple insight a day, over time, and in a very short period of time, you can become a more effective investor. And the idea is you can just keep becoming a more and more effective investor as you're exposed to more and more good, sound investing ideas.
So I would recommend that if listeners want to learn more, go and check our show notes on the website at promoneytalk.com. We'll have links to Russ's resources, and I would second that thought, that find some trustworthy resources, listen to them, tune into them, read them, let this stuff sink in. The terminology may seem strange at first, the concepts are strange, but it's not rocket science. It does come down to integrity, trustworthiness, some basic factors that over time, you know, add up to something meaningful for people. So thank you for spending the time with us and sharing your thoughts. I know that you've put an awful lot of your own energy over the last how many years in building your philosophy, and appreciate you spending time with us and sharing it.
It's truly my pleasure. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Russ and Peter. Well, that's it for our show today. Thanks again to Russ Town and Nick Waschesen for being part of our show. For complete show notes and links to more information, please go to our website at www.promoneytalk.com. Once again, that's www.promoneytalk.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week.